Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
There have been many books about Steve Jobs, one of the most famous CEOs in history, but the new book, Becoming Steve Jobs, takes on and breaks down the existing myth and stereotypes about Steve Jobs. The conventional view of Jobs is that he was half genius, half jerk from youth, an irascible and selfish leader who slighted friends and family alike. Becoming Steve Jobs answers the central question about the life and career of the Apple co-founder and CEO. How did a young man so reckless and arrogant that he was exiled from the company that he founded become the most effective visionary business leader of our time, ultimately transforming the daily lives of billions of people? The new book is Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. Journalist Brent Schlender and Rick Tazzelli are the authors, and they join us this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much.
Brent is one of the premier chroniclers of the personal computer revolution, having written about just about every major figure in the tech industry and covered Steve Jobs for the Wall Street Journal and Fortune. Rick is an executive editor of Fast Company and has covered technology for the past two decades. How did the two of you come together, Brent, to take on this project?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please?
I sure can. How did the two of you come together, working together on this particular project?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't hear. It actually goes way, way back. Rick and I worked together at Fortune for many years. He was my story editor for many of those years and was the primary editor of several cover stories that I wrote there about Steve Jobs and Apple, as well as several more about Bill Gates and about Andy Grove of Intel and other giants of the Silicon Valley world. And so we had done a lot of work together, and then after Steve passed away, about a year after that, I told him I'd found some old interviews, and then I thought maybe we could build a story around some of the things that went on during the so-called wilderness years that might explain a little better how Steve became so much more effective. So we did that for Fast Company, and it was kind of a viral sensation on the web when we published it. We suddenly realized, boy, there's a lot of interest still in Steve Jobs. And so we whipped together a book proposal and found a publisher and went to work.
Rick, do you get the sense, because this has been said even in the press materials for the book, that there was a sense that you wanted to write the record, that you felt that the full story of this man was not being told, and if it was being told, perhaps a little bit too harshly?
Well, our primary, we're both business journalists first and foremost, and we were really interested in understanding how somebody who was an immature and ineffective businessman at the beginning of his life could become the person who, made Apple such an incredible success at the end of his life. Something happened. Something changed. And we felt that really hadn't been documented well. Steve himself was not a retrospective guy. He didn't like to say, I learned that from so-and-so, or, failing at that made me realize that I should do things this way instead. So we had to piece that together. And I think our book shows how he changed and why he changed, and it shows how he applied those lessons to Apple. The young man who failed at Apple in the first go round could never have succeeded the way he did at Apple later.
How much do you think was that early failure and having that anguish to then come back and have a second chance? How much is that a part of the story?
Well, he always felt, Steve felt that he was incredibly lucky to get a second chance at Apple. He was really grateful for that. And so when he came back, he applied himself with a level of discipline that he hadn't had earlier in his life. He didn't want to screw up his opportunity a second time.
And Brent, did his illness have an impact on his personality and how he viewed things?
Well, clearly, a life-threatening illness has a profound effect on how you look at yourself, how you look at your family, how you look at the world around you, and the time you may or may not have left. And so it has sort of a crystallizing effect on your priorities in life. And Steve already had pretty crystalline priorities about his life. He also, even before he was diagnosed with the cancer, always mentioned that he tried to live his life as if every day was the last one he would be alive, so that he wouldn't regret what he did with his time. And so it was a shift, obviously, because now it's for real. He was facing death right there in front of him. But he had been behaving in that way anyway, I would say, since he left Apple the first time, because he knew that's the only way he could get motivated enough and have enough clarity in his mind to move forward.
Talk a little bit, if you will, Rick, about that idea of his being reckless and arrogant, of how, not how that led to his exile from the company in the beginning, but ultimately how those there with that comes a confidence in what you're doing, an understanding of what you're doing, and a confidence that comes with it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is the thing. When he was a young man, he was an inspirational guy. I mean, he was inspirational as an older man as well. And, you know, he and Steve Wozniak, when they, started Apple, they didn't know where things were going to go. They didn't see the grand scheme. They just had a cool product, and they wanted to sell some and make some money. And even later, when the company had gotten much bigger and he set out to create the Macintosh, he led this small group of people and he inspired them and he pushed them and he scolded them and he cajoled them. But it was this sort of wild, crazy, charming energy, which is great, you know? We need that. But you can't run a company that way for the long haul. And that was the problem. That's why he got exiled.
So then you tell the story about Tim Cook, and Steve Jobs is bedridden. He's on a liver transplant list, and Tim Cook has done all kinds of due diligence in finding out if he would be able to be a donor. And he goes to Steve Jobs, and he makes the offer. So I'll leave it up to which one of you would like to take on the answering of this, of what that moment was like, and what it tells us ultimately about Steve Jobs.
Well, I'll take a crack at it. This is Brent. It was very dramatic because neither Rick nor I don't think, or anybody else, there was four of us in the room, nor the PR person who was with Tim expected a story like this. We were asking him what was misunderstood about Steve, because he mentioned that early on in the interview that he thought Steve was still very misunderstood, and that he made the point that why would I ever work for somebody for 14 years who was a jerk and rude. And he said it just wasn't that way. In fact, he wasn't even selfish. And then he told that story. And the story was about Tim recognizing that he had the same rare blood type as Steve, which had the bad effect on Steve of really limiting the number of livers that could be available for transplant to him. And so, and time was running out. So Tim went and secretly had the workup done to see if his proper state of health and there was enough compatibility in their blood types and everything else that he could donate part of his liver, which would regenerate in Steve to a functional size, and then his would grow back. This happens a lot. It's not like it's some wild, like heart transplant, like surgical method. It's fairly reliable. So the risk probably wasn't as much as Steve may have thought it was. But what happened was that Steve just would not even consider the possibility of taking part of Tim's liver. And to me, Tim didn't say this. Tim was just telling us this just to show, look, that guy, if he was dying to live, he would have taken it. If he would do anything to live, if he was selfish and purely self-centered and self-motivated, he would have taken it because it's so hard to find one that's compatible when you have that blood type. But the reason he didn't was that he did not want to jeopardize Tim, because Tim was his chosen successor. Tim was the guy that he knew was the best to run Apple if Steve was gone. And so the last thing he wanted to do was put him at risk, too. So it was a very interesting, sort of poignant story that was very emotional to hear him tell.
And obviously something, Rick, I think that and your book is about Steve Jobs, but of course it's also about Apple. But obviously it has a profound impact on Tim Cook and what he does as well in the future, right?
Well, I think Cook learned a lot from Jobs, even though they were very, very different people. There are management practices that Jobs set in place during the last years of his life that are still critical to Apple. I mean, one of these is the reliance on small teams. Apple is really insistent on limiting the number of people working on a particular project, keeping things down to small groups that are assigned to discrete elements of a big project. That's critical to how they run things, and that was very much something that the mature Steve Jobs developed and that the young Steve Jobs never could have developed.
You talk, Brent, about him being very, in the beginning, being very isolated, being very much a loner, and then suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but certainly looking to become a better leader, and the leadership qualities that we spoke of a moment ago, but to become more inclusive and to really build a team. And not only to say, okay, I'm going to do that, but to do it so successfully.
Well, I think one of the things we point to is what he learned from his side project, at least that's what he at first called it, Pixar, which is was the graphic special effects unit, computerized graphics,
right,
for Lucasfilm that George Lucas had put on the market, and Steve tried to get Apple to buy it, and Apple wasn't interested. And so Steve, after he left Apple, decided, well, I'll just buy it. He didn't really know what he was getting. He knew these guys were smart. He thought 3D graphics was really cool and that maybe the medical world could use it, or even engineers. or artists even, to make three-dimensional objects with computer that would be beautiful and easy to manipulate. That, and so his whole intention was to start yet another computer company, turn that into yet another computer company for very specialized computers. What he got, though, actually, was a very cohesive team of really intelligent people who had their own ideas of what they wanted to do, namely make animated movies and cartoons. These guys are scientists, and they want to make cartoons. So they were unusual people to begin with. And they had an exceptionally skilled boss named Ed Catmull, who was about as enlightened a boss as Steve had ever come across in the way he handled highly creative people and the way he steered people. He was the polar opposite of Steve in terms of temperament. And Steve watched this guy keep this company going through thick and thin, and then really keep it on the rails as it had tremendous success, first with Toy Story and then thereafter. So he learned a lot from observing somebody who was very different from him.
Talk a little bit about the relationship. You had mentioned this, but talk a little bit, Rick, about the relationship between Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak.
Well, you know, they started out sharing an interest in tinkering and in hobbies, and their experiments eventually led to the creation of the Apple II, which was really the first personal computer, and they were very, very close at the beginning, but temperamentally, they were very, very different people. And they sort of went different ways naturally. Steve was Steve was always interested in growing the company and in making it bigger and new and better things. Woz was not, and Woz would have been happy for things to sort of remain the way they had been. So their relationship grew distant over the years, although there was always some fondness underlying whatever bitterness or whatever problems emerged over the long haul.
Because you even say in the book that he would prioritize people and
he did. He prioritized rigorously. This was one of the things that we discovered. Really was an understanding that if you were in his close circle of colleagues, close circle of friends, or if you were a family member, you saw a humane, sensitive side of Steve that a lot of other people didn't see. Apple was very, very high on his list of priorities. And so if you were outside of that circle and you weren't of service to Apple, if what you were doing wasn't helping Apple, he didn't, he didn't treat you with the manners that you or I might use. So...
Which is a polite way of saying, because you use the word in the book,
he could be a jerk,
right? But he would be very dismissive of you.
He could be very dismissive, and here's the thing, though. He was dismissive of people within that circle, but of their ideas sometimes. But they fought back. They fought back all the time. Susan Barnes, who was the financial manager on the Mac team and was the chief financial officer of Next, told us that you had to listen through the yelling. You had to understand what the yelling was all about. And the strongest people did that. John Rubinstein, who worked for him for years and years and years, told us stories about, you know, the two of them yelling at each other on Christmas morning, going back and forth on the phone, you know, over some detail that was just driving Steve crazy. And Ruby, as his nickname is, you know, he gave it back to Steve as good as he got it. And that was part of how you established a long-term relationship with Steve. You had to fight back.
The name of the book is Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. The book is published by Crown Business and written by journalists Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli. It is, again, Becoming Steve Jobs, out from Crown. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us and for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Very nice to have you with us. Again, the title of the book, Becoming Steve Jobs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.